You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
The Cleveland.com podcast with Terry Pluto, award-winning columnist for Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer, and me, your host, David Campbell. Terry, big news this week. A lot of fans are upset. The Choco Taco, the Klondike ice cream product that's shaped like a taco, is being discontinued. People are upset. Are you a big ice cream guy, Terry? Did this affect you in any way or not?
I like ice cream, but I've never had a Choco Taco. I sort of like the stuff that you know, whether it's Dairy Queen or somewhere else, but I'm pretty boring. I like chocolate, cookies and cream.
Yeah, the standards. You can still find these around, but like Klondike is apparently streamlining their product line, and this was the one that died. And a lot of people love the Choco Taco, Terry.
I will say this. My mother-in-law ate a Klondike bar probably for 50 years or more before she passed away in 2014. She loved the classic Klondike.
They're the best. There's no doubt about it. So this is the part of the show where if there's any ice cream makers in town who want to sponsor the podcast, here is your opportunity.
Here's your chance.
All right, Terry, let's get into Browns. The Browns started training camp today. We're taping this on Wednesday afternoon. Mm-hmm. And Lance Risland, who is our film breakdown coach analyst, has been tweeting video of Nick Chubb and Kareem Hunt in the backfield together, which finally might be a thing more than it has been in the past. But what are you expecting from training camp? I know you usually go out there for a few days.
Yeah.
But what are you looking to see from the Browns as they camp here?
Well, in terms of the Hunt and Chubb, you could say it's about time. And also, this is what happens when you don't go into camp with Odell or Jarvis Landry. Because you're really looking for other guys that can catch the ball. And Kareem could do that. You could put him in the slot. You could do a lot of things with him. So, and then on top of it, David Bell, it's kind of unclear what they're doing, you know, what they're saying with him. Yeah, these guys with NFL injuries, you can't believe a whole lot. So, like, it's not that bad, but who knows, et cetera. And so when you start breaking down the receivers, David, all right, so the number one receiver is easy. Who's that?
Amari Cooper.
And now you have to pick number two.
Well, to me, it's Donovan Peoples-Jones just because he's been here and he's proven he can make some big plays, right? Are you in the same place on that?
Oh, yeah. I think Jones has a chance to be good. I still do. And then after that,
number three.
Yeah, I mean, it was supposed to be Bell, but I don't know. I mean, you'd start going to – that's the problem. You know, they're using Felton quite a bit as a receiver. There was the kid from Louisiana Lafayette, and his name escapes me at the moment, who caught a few balls last year. But I just think that they're going to be doing more with the running backs in terms of, you know, what they could do to get people to catch the ball. And I just really am anxious to see Kareem back because they did miss him quite a bit last year. And he also was such a good short yardage guy, you know, sometimes better a short yardage guy than Jamarcus Bradley was the guy I was trying to think of. You know, they have Jakeen Grant, you know, maybe not, you know, depends how you feel about him. All right, I'm going to ask you about Anthony Schwartz. I was ignoring it, but it has to be mentioned.
What I think about him?
Yes.
So Mary Kay Cabot, our colleague, interviewed him, and they got into a discussion about how hard it's been for him because he was the receiver who kind of truncated his route that caused the interception that Baker Mayfield went to go make the tackle on, that caused the injury that kind of upset the whole season last year. So he's had to deal with kind of the fallout from that. But you know how it is, Terry, like rookies are rookies. And boy, you probably have an Earl Weaver quote about rookies, but yeah. I remember the old Al McGuire one. The best thing about freshmen is that they become sophomores. But with Schwartz going into his second year, that kind of stuff has to end. Like the quarterback has to throw the ball to where he knows you're going to be. Mm-hmm. And it can't be a 50-50 proposition. And that little stuff, you know, when you're supposed to be on the hash, when you end your route, you better be on the hash. And if he cleans that up, I think he has the physical tools and he's got a year under his belt. I think the Browns think he can make some plays in this offense. How are you feeling about him?
Well, a couple of things on Schwartz. Number one is durability was a problem last year, and durability was a problem with him in college at Auburn. You know, he's an Olympic sprinter. So that's one. And two, he did drop some balls. Now, the flip side is sometimes those guys do come around. You know, they get some good coaching. They can begin to figure it out. But so, you know, I have now the list of all the receivers in front of me. So right now you go with – you have with Cooper, number one. Clearly Peoples-Jones is number two. You know, Bell would be three if he's healthy. But let's knock him out because he's not. You know, the old Earl Weaver line, you mentioned him when I asked him about a player who was hurt. Well, he's dead to me. And that was the exact quote. And I'm like staring, and he knew he did that to shake me up, the Orioles manager. And he goes, look, kid, I can't play him. I don't want him dead. I want him alive. But when you sit there in my desk, as he was sitting at his desk right here, and you're making your lineup, you can't put a dead guy in the lineup. It doesn't work. So what else you want to know? And that's what he would say. And don't ask him to play doctor. That would be even worse. Okay, so we're taking Bell out. So you've got Cooper. You've got Peoples-Jones. You've got Schwartz, I guess, would be third. Maybe Jakeem Grant, although they really see – he's 5'7". They see him more as a, you know, a return guy. I do know that the front office, the player personnel side, does like Jamarcus Bradley. So he's back. And then I forgot about this guy. They did draft him in the seventh round, Michael Woods from Oklahoma. So there you go. Take your pick. Sixth round, pick number 202 on Woods. So it's kind of thin, but that's why I believe that you're going to see Felton, you're going to see Kareem Hunt, you're going to see, I think, in preseason quite a bit of Ford from Cincinnati catching some balls and working out of the backfield. So they're going to do a lot of that kind of stuff. And then maybe, just maybe, the tight end friendly offense could be friendly for tight ends.
Well, I'll tell you what I would like to see from the Browns. And we won't see this, Terry, until the real games start in September. But and I think we've talked about this over the last several months. But the best three offensive players on the Browns right now are Nick Chubb, Kareem Hunt, and Amari Cooper. I mean, if you take the quarterback out of the equation, the quarterback is going to be whoever it's going to be. And I felt like last year there were too many times where the Browns were so into their structure that they didn't have their two or three best offensive players on the field at the same time. And you remember when it was coming out of the two-minute drill and Nick Chubb wouldn't be in the game?
Yeah.
And it's like Nick Chubb should be in. And split Kareem Hunt out wide, even if he's just a decoy. Like, you need to have threats on the field, even if they're not going to get the ball. And I think the Browns need to be as flexible as they can be. And you've written about them revamping the passing game and trying to make it more fluid and have more options and have more plugging in different guys in different places. I think that's got to be – you got to find a way to get your best guys on the field at the crucial times and have things work so where they're playing off of each other. Instead,
you also could just fake the ball to Chubb.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're throwing it. And they will pay attention to that. So – that's a thing there and sometimes act like Chubb has the worst hands in NFL history, and that's just not true. But you know,
yeah,
I look at this,
go ahead, Terry.
You know, I just look at this grouping here, but if it flips back to they just gave, you know, big money. When you look at that, they've gave big money to Chubb. and he gave big money to Njoku. I'm just looking at your skilled position, guys. So they should be using Njoku more as a receiver for that. Now, they almost consider Harrison Bryant kind of a hybrid tight end receiver type. So maybe we'll see more of him too. But, you know, this is going to be a challenge. Even with Watson, I think it's going to be a challenge for Stefanski to figure out exactly what the offense is supposed to look like, because they didn't like what it looked like last year. And to say it's all Baker Mayfield is just flat out unfair. As you mentioned, some of the schematic things were. Other times, he would be so caught up in trying to force the passing game, he ignore the running game. I don't care that the Browns threw the sixth fewest passes in the NFL. When your strength is running the ball, now I don't want to just, you know, throw 12 passes a game and run it all the time there, but, you know, play to your strength.
All right, Terry, the big decision that is hanging over everything, and who knows, it could be being made right now and announced while we're taping here, is the Deshaun Watson suspension. And just to recap for everybody, the way it's going to work is Sue L. Robinson, who is hearing the evidence from both sides, has heard it. She's going to make a ruling. If she instills any kind of discipline, whether it's a fine, suspension, it then goes to the commissioner's office, and Roger Goodell or one of his appointees can do whatever they want with that. Raise it, lower it, whatever. If there's no discipline, then he has no recourse. If that's the decision. So I don't know if we've ever really gotten into this, Terry. So I want to kind of put you into Roger Goodell's chair for a minute. And we've heard all the evidence. This has been going on for months. It's now the start of training camp. How many games, if you're Roger Goodell, Terry Pluto sitting in the chair, how many games are you going to suspend him if something comes to you and you get to make the final decision?
I mean, the problem is, like we say, we've seen all the evidence. We haven't. We really don't know exactly. We've heard a lot of what people say. We don't know a lot of what was done. Now, this may sound like a dodge or whatever, but I found this, whereas I was very adamant on what should be done with the Houston Texans, because they immediately settled 30 cases with different women. They never denied that they gave non-disclosure agreements, nor did they deny that they paid for hotel suites for Watson to get these massages. A team that does that is totally out of bounds. They should lose draft choices. I would take like a second and a third or something like that. I'd slam them. I don't want that going on, because that is just flat out sanctioning, you know, really bad behavior. And on top of it, having your player trying to help them cover it up. So that's team. That's easy. Now, Watson, you know, you get into all this stuff. And, you know, if you read through some of those things, of course, it's stomach churning on both ends. And who did what? And who said what? You know, your head just explodes. That's the harder part for me. And one of the things you do have to ask yourself is, if Deshaun Watson were a Pittsburgh quarterback sitting in front of Judge Robinson, what would you feel the penalty ought to be, as opposed to he's a Browns quarterback?
Why would they make a difference?
Was because I think in terms of being a fan, you would think, you know, how could they allow this? But it's like, when he's your guy, you feel differently about it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. When I get the mail, I've even answered a couple. Well, would you feel the same way if Pittsburgh or some other quarterback, some other team had signed him and gotten into, you know, this whole quagmire? So, you know, you don't like it. I intentionally haven't written how many games, because I can't come up with anything. I feel very uncomfortable, whereas I feel very comfortable on the Texans thing, because I know what happened there. And by the way that they settled it so quickly in that, it told you. Here, I just, you know, then you get into, you know, the ridiculous defense of, you know, the happy endings defense by the lawyer, for which would have been the last day that guy would have represented me. And then you get into, you know, a mishmash of charges and countercharges. You know, I find it very difficult. I mean, look, this is a league that suspended four games for Tom Brady for deflating footballs, and gave Myles Garrett six games for getting into a fight. It was on the field. Yeah, he got the helmet, but it's a fight on the field. And, you know, Myles was kicked and all kinds of stuff like that. You know, it's also a league that, according to what I was told, the Browns research showed that the only people that have been suspended for a full year either were facing felonies or on gambling charges. Now, if that holds up, then he shouldn't get a full year. But right now you're in a whole new way of judging things. But I'm just saying there that the Watson case is really complicated. And I guess that is why Robinson, the judge, is still trying to sort through all this. And it's probably why she wishes the Players Association and the NFL could come out of there and say, okay, we agree on 12 games or something, or 8 games. Because she is probably very complicated. Because otherwise, I think she'd have been out with something right away.
No, you make some good points, Terry. And you know, I shouldn't have said we know all the evidence, because obviously we don't. And thanks for clarifying that. But we know everything we're going to know until this thing is announced.
Mm-hmm. And it'll be very interesting to see if she releases the entire thing of her ruling, or does she just say, oh, I say 9 games.
Right. And I think 8 or 9 games, I think that's where it's going to end up. And I know everybody's just kind of guessing at that. But if you think about it, Terry, this is a decision. The big rock is going to fall into the ocean, and there's going to be ripples that are going to happen mm-hmm. after this. There's the NFLPA. There's mm-hmm. the women's groups who have been very upset about this from the beginning. There are fans. There are, you know, there's Deshaun Watson and his camp. There's a lot of parties that need to feel that this was a just decision when it's over. And I think as you
My guess
out,
is they make nobody happy. So
yeah,
that's probably it.
Right.
What's maybe the old, maybe that,
what's,
maybe
what's
that's
the old
best.
Journalism saying? The old journalism saying, if you're making everybody upset, you're doing your job right or something.
Yeah.
That's probably Roger Goodell's going to have to kind of find a good middle ground there that will work for everybody. And that's why I think you're right. I think the Calvin Ridley, you know, who got a year suspension for gambling on football, I think that probably would be seen as excessive. And I do think 8 to 9 games does feel about right where it would.
But what we think it feels or whatever, we don't know. She's the one sitting there.
That's true.
And she may also have orders from the league in terms of this is how we want to view this. Not telling her what to do, but we consider this, you know, extremely serious. Or they could say, we just want you to find something that's fair. Look at some of the other rulings and come out with. I don't know what she was told. I know this. I am glad I'm not spending hours after hours, day after day, month after month, going through all the junk in this case. So yeah, how do you feel about Joshua Dobbs? We found out a little bit how they feel about Joshua Dobbs today.
We did, yeah.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk about that for a second, Terry? Go ahead.
Well, my guy, Josh Rosen, is finally a Brown. You know, I wrote that how he was my number one quarterback in the 2018 draft when I rated him. It was Rosen 1, Allen 2, Baker 3. I didn't like Darnold at all. Darnold and Jackson, I basically said I thought there were 3 quarterbacks in the draft. So I was really wrong because I just dismissed Jackson out of hand as an athlete, et cetera. I fell in love with Rosen because he really, if you go back and look at him, UCLA, he threw a pretty ball in that. I did not like Darnold because he had a tremendous amount of turnovers, not just interceptions. You look at how many fumbles he had back at USC. So you go through all that, but today, Kevin Stefanski said that, you know, as of now, Joshua Dobbs is ahead of Rosen. Of course, Rosen just got here. That's why. But, you know, Rosen's been, I think this is 15. There's a reason that he's been bouncing around.
Yeah. And you know, remember when he was coming out of UCLA, Terry, he didn't have the best reputation as being a good teammate. There was a lot of people put pictures on social media. I think he had a hot tub in his dorm room and
being kind of distant.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing with him, he did have a significant history of concussions. And so, but I remember watching the game that kind of sold me on Rosen is he played against Darnold, and I watched this game, and USC had like twice the talent UCLA did. Rosen kept it close. His guys were dropping balls, jumping off sides, and he's hanging in a pocket. He's taking hits, and he's making good throws. And really, Darnold should just pick them apart and all that. And he had a good game, but nothing like what he should have. And then if you remember when Darnold played against Ohio State, he got crushed. So that was there. But, you know, I liked Allen because, one, I have a Wyoming hat on. I've always been partial University of Wyoming ever since a friend of mine, Larry Shiat from Cleveland, became head basketball coach there. And I also like Wyoming as a state. So I did pay attention to the guy. I thought, you know, this guy, like, They got an NFL-style quarterback at Wyoming. He's playing under center. They're running an NFL-type offense because this is the same coach who also had Carson Wentz at North Dakota State. So he ran, you know, a pretty good offense with that. But I don't think – maybe Buffalo thought Allen was going to be this good, but I doubt it. I think they just wanted somebody who's decent. And so that's a – it's going to be fun to still see how it all plays out. But, yeah, Joshua Dobbs is 3, Rosen's 4, Brissett starts, we wait.
All right, and you know how it is, Terry. We see this in sports all the time, but sometimes a guy coming out of college or when he's young thinks he's the you know, the world's gift to whatever position they play. And when it takes 25, 26, 27, and they've been through things and mm-hmm. they find out that this is a business and they got to put
I'd like to go back.
Maybe
I
he's in that stage. I don't know.
It'd be fun to have. In fact, maybe that's something for your football writers, you are there, to have them go through. Find somebody like Rosen who was, say, picked in the top 10, bounced around for 3 or 4 years, and then suddenly became a starter and did pretty well somewhere. No one comes to mind for me.
The one who's coming to mind for me immediately, but he hasn't done it yet, is Mitch Trubisky. But that would be a good example. If he's able to win the starting job in Pittsburgh and hold it and do some things there, he's –
Some people mentioned Ryan Tannehill, but he started quite a bit with Miami. I mean, I'm talking about a guy. He started 13 games, I think, his first year, Rosen did. And then he's 3-10.
Trubisky has more than that. So,
right. But, and then he started a couple of games after that and was a disaster. So we'll see. But there might be somebody out there. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll have to check into that. So, all right, Terry, you want to move into the Guardians a little bit
here?
All right, let's do it. So the trade deadline is coming up next week. Guardians coming out of the All-Star break are 49-47. They're 2.5 games behind the Twins. They had a big win in Boston last night. You've been doing a little bit of reporting, and I think you, in your column that will appear tomorrow, you've been writing about the Guardians trying to thread the needle, which is what they say when they're trying to stay in contention and not mortgage the future but still contend. And you're hearing some interesting names, including Oakland catcher Sean Murphy as someone who might be on their radar heading into next week's trade deadline.
Yeah, they're, you know, stuff like Juan Soto or whatever, that's not going to happen. You hear Brian Reynolds from the Pirates, but I think that's less likely. The one position they do need help, and fans have been crying about this justifiably for the last couple of years, is catcher. Because it's a position where people don't hit to begin with. Last time I looked, the average major league catcher was batting like .218. But, of course, that would be like a 30-point improvement or more for the Guardians. I don't know what these guys are hitting. We'll look it up in a moment. And I heard for months they really like Sean Murphy from Oakland. Furthermore, Oakland not only is kind of looking to move guys, they have a couple of catchers in AAA they really, really like. So it's not like and Murphy fits the profile. You know, he won't be a free agent until 2026. He's a Wright State product. He's 27. He won a Gold Glove last year. Remember, the catcher that they would trade for has to be really good defensively. They consider it a defensive position. You know, this year he's hitting .244, .747 OPS with 11 homers. I mean, that makes him sound like Johnny Bench in his prime compared to what we've been watching. 24 doubles. I mean, he's just a really good player. So it also fits what I was told. If the Guardians make a big deal, it would be for a guy like that with several years of team control, the right age where they could have him not just – they don't – I'm not saying – no, do they care about making a big run this year? No, they don't. They'd like to do it with the roster they have, but they're not going to try and just bring in some guys to hold the fort. And just then see where they're at. No, they're looking down the road. So that's why Murphy, I think, is going to be a main target for them. Of course, for other teams too. Everybody, you know, like half of the league or more needs a catcher. But the thing that helps, you know, the Guardians have a lot of prospects. And the nice thing that I like about the Murphy thing is they would not have to trade Bo Naylor in that. Naylor, you know, he's 22. That's Josh's brother. And he's his first couple of years – he struggled. He's a first-round pick in 18. But, you know, this year between AA and AAA, he's hitting .283 with a .944 OPS, 10 homers. He walks a lot. He's a good defensive catcher. So when you start thinking about Naylor and Murphy, that changes the whole dynamic of that position. It also means you don't have to hand 23-year-old Josh Naylor the starting job in spring training because they put a lot on their catchers.
It would make a lot of sense, Terry, and they are. They're kind of buying time until Naylor can come up. And Murphy, you talked about the team control. He would elevate the stats and everything. So moving away from catcher, Brian Reynolds of the Pirates is another name you've been hearing.
I've heard that forever with them. And he's, you know, he's under team control for a couple of years with the Pirates, I think three more years. But as I was talking to some people, it's like, you know, it used to be Cleveland desperate for outfielders. But I don't think that's the case anymore because, you know, Stephen Kwan, we've kind of said this, you know, he's had a really good year. I mean, here's, you want to win some money? Who has the best on-base percentage on the Guardians?
Is it Stephen Kwan?
Yeah, because I thought for sure it was Jose. He's actually higher now than Jose. And he's hitting .295. He's got more walks than strikeouts. He plays a good left field. He took care of the leadoff spot. I mean, that's set. Miles Straw is a career .250 hitter. Now, I know he's had a miserable year. He started hitting July, but, you know, he's an elite center fielder. So you're really looking at right field. And now here come the guys, you know, Nolan Jones, Oscar Gonzalez, those two. And then in the minors, Will Benson and my guy, Will Brennan, who, let's see, where is he right now? Will, what are you hitting? Come on, tell me the truth. You are hitting .328. And you only have 79 RBIs in 84 games. So you have Will Benson. It's another guy, AAA. You have Will Benson. You have Will Brennan. And you have Gonzalez. And you have Nolan Jones. And by the way, they've just started playing Will Benson at first base in the minors. And my theory is Nolan Jones could end up be there. So I think between those spots, you're kind of fixing an outfield first base. So if they make a big deal, you know, where they're giving up some of their key pitching prospects or stuff like that. Not Gavin Williams, you know, not Espino, but I'll tell you this, Espino has not been able to get healthy this year. Hate high school pitchers drafted in the first or second round. They just get hurt. And even McKenzie, who was drafted high, you know, it took him several seasons. Now, at least he didn't have Tommy John. But remember, he would hurt his arm and this and that. It just seems as though it's a very difficult thing. I remember I said this to somebody with the old Indians organization back then, and they're kind of going through the head, go, well, what about CC Sabathia? I said, fine. We got to go back to the last century. There's your guy. There's CC Sabathia. Jarrett Wright, maybe, you know. But really, they just don't last very long. And that's why, you know, that's why they're so careful with Espino. They have Logan T. Allen. They have several of those guys that would be attractive. See, Oakland wants prospects. That's why I just think the thing makes a lot more sense for Murphy. It's a bigger need than bringing Brian Reynolds in for the outfield.
So, Terry, it seems like things are really congealing here with all these guys who can play the outfield, and they're moving some of them to some reps at first base. Mm-hmm. The guy that we haven't talked about, who's kind of could be the odd man out here, and we mentioned this a little bit last week, was Franmil Reyes.
Yeah.
You want him? Watching the game Sunday, he's battling the strike zone so hard. Like his pitch selection just doesn't seem like it's been in the past. And I know they asked him to lose some weight, but the Guardians had a chance in Sunday's game against the White Sox to score some runs. He swung at a bad pitch, grounded into a double play, and barely got beat out at first base on the throw to first. And I know they've been wanting him to lose some weight, and all I could think of was, if he just would have dropped those 10 pounds, he might have beaten that grounder and not had the double play. But maybe we can run through a few guys. But will Franmil Reyes be with the Guardians on August 3rd? You think he'll be here or not?
For his sake and the team's sake, I hope not, because he really has gone down in estimation by there. And his teammates, you know, this is a hard-driving team, David. They run hard to first base. They play hard. They're not always smart, but, I mean, as Francona keeps saying, they keep playing. You know, the leaders on the team because they don't need too many older guys, are Jose and are Ahmed Rosario. And those guys just bust their butt all the time. And they look at Reyes, and they don't see that. The other player, I was talking to somebody very close that said they don't see it in Reyes. They see a guy who got kind of fat and just sort of there, and now Reyes is swinging at pitches. You know, look, you get two strikes on him, throw the ball about a foot outside, he's going to swing at it. He's making up his mind early, which means he doesn't have confidence. He's going to get around a fastball. He's guessing. So I think they'd love to get rid of him. I don't know what his market value is, but you might be able to find somebody just to take him for the rest of the year and say, hey, he's hit 30 homers a couple times.
Well, and if not, I wonder if they might do the Oscar Mercado thing where they DFA him and see who takes him if they can't get anything for
him. Yeah, maybe somebody
could. And you've been talking about this, Terry. They need to find at-bats for guys, and they need to find time at first base for guys. And and DH, those are valuable things on this team right now. And, yeah, it makes you wonder if they're going to do the same thing. So,
and also, you don't want Josh Naylor, I think, in the field 5 and 6 days a week. It's remarkable he's playing at all. I mean, that was a career-threatening broken leg, fractured tibia, all kinds of stuff. He's got more I forgot how many screws and plates are in that foot and leg. It's a lot. And you would want him maybe half the time DHing, half the time first base or something like that. And so that's but now he's another one. He plays like every game. His life is on the line. See, that's the whole culture of that team. Franmil is not doing that. It's not because maybe it's because he's not hitting, he's pouting, but it just doesn't fit what they're doing.
All right, next on my list after Franmil, Shane Bieber, Terry. You've been writing about Jeff Passan of ESPN that Shane Bieber is available, but it's going to take a lot to get him out of Cleveland. Will Shane
he said
Bieber
the price is exorbitant. And if you're the price is exorbitant, well, there's a lot of guys on that team you could probably get for an exorbitant price. Jose's not one because he has a no trade. That would be interesting to see. I mean, I wouldn't be totally shocked. I could not believe it at all if Bieber were traded. But I think it makes more sense if you're thinking about dealing him down the line to wait until the offseason. He still has 2 more years of team control. Interesting thing about Bieber, they've made him offers in the past for extensions. By the way, pitchers, this is another one of my theories, like a high school pitcher thing, stay away in the high rounds. Generally, pitchers, when you are offered that first extension, a younger pitcher, take it because of the injury thing. I don't think Carlos Carrasco ever regretted taking that contract extension. I don't think Corey Kluber regretted taking his contract extension. And I do know Clevinger was offered something like $35 million or more a few years ago, and he turned it down. I think he regressed that. And because almost all these guys end up with some type of injury. And then they have plenty of time to come back. And the other thing, when you're on a long-term contract and you're a pitcher and you're coming off of an injury, you don't rush yourself back because you're not playing for your paycheck. So I really believe that that's one factor. But he's turned them down a couple times, Bieber. Secondly, Bieber's represented by the Drew Rosenhaus Agency, and they hired a guy whose name escapes me at the moment to run their baseball thing, and he is a Scott Boras disciple. And, you know, that's the Darth Vader of baseball agents. You know, Boras is the guy that turned down over $400 million from Washington for Juan Soto because he wants $500 million. So this is probably not going to end well in terms of an extension. That's why you can't ignore the fact that it's a possibility they could move Bieber. And, you know, and Bieber is throwing 90, 91 miles an hour compared to 94 Cy Young Award year. I don't think he's hurt, David, but I do believe, you know, he missed 3 months last year with the shoulder thing. I think he's being trying to find a real comfort level for throwing with that arm. Now he's
going
still
for
good.
Longevity like instead of trying to, yeah.
And that shakes you, and it shakes you up a little bit, you know, when that happens. And then you look, you turn around, you know, there's Savali. He can't get healthy. I forgot what is a glute injury. I forgot what he has now.
It's gluteus, but before
Then he had the finger. Oh no, it's a wrist. He has a wrist. That's the problem. When there's too many injuries and body parts to mention,
You know you have issues. So.
Yeah.
All right, Terry. So, yeah. 15 seconds. Okay. We talked last week about Ahmed Rosario, and he's just so important to what this team is. If they were to move him, it would damage more than – you'd be losing more than just a player here. You'd be losing kind of an important part of the culture. And so he'll be here, right?
You suspect I think so. Unless that would turn around where you're trading him and Bieber and there's some other huge thing coming back. It would be something like that. But otherwise it is. I mean, I was just told by a top executive from Cleveland that we consider him an extraordinary cultural fit for the team and a very good major league player. And I agree on both. You know, and his defense is short has improved this year. I was down on his defense last year, but he's average. And I was looking kind of at some of the analytics. He's in the middle of the pack there. But I just, you know, Frank Cohn always talks about playing a game the right way or whatever. Well, when you have those guys doing that, you know, when you at the top of the lineup and you have Kwan and you have Rosario and you have Jose and you have Naylor batting fourth, I mean, these are guys that you really, and how about, and you talk about things, you know, the big plan. Let's see if Jimenez can play. Yes, he can. He's become an all-star second baseman. You can play short, he can play second. You know, let's see what you've got with Naylor. You know, they didn't talk a lot about that, but they were hoping. You know, Naylor's a hitter. You know, Naylor can help you. Let's see what they got with Kwan. You've got a leadoff hitter. You don't see what you got. You don't find those out unless you play them. Owen Miller is still sort of in the middle of, well, what is he? You know. And then you saw Bobby Bradley didn't work. Yu Chang didn't work. Oscar Mercado didn't work. I'm sure I'm forgetting some others, but those are some quick ones there. By the way, Brian LaVista, remember he was supposed to be a prospect? He's just like falling off the map. He's like down in double A. He's at like 210 this year.
Right?
LaVista, yeah.
Yep.
And boy, he's really struggling. That's another reason I went back to Sean Murphy. That's the area of need.
All right, so trade deadline is on Tuesday, August 2nd, I believe that is, if I don't have my calendar in front of me, but we shall see how that all shakes out. Terry, we got to take a break. When we come back, let's kind of bring some closure to your three-part Jim Donovan column package that you had last week, and we'll get into your faith column a little bit. We'll answer some Hey Terry questions, and we'll be right back on Terry's Talking.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're back on Terry's Talking, David Campbell and Terry Pluto. Terry, we got some really great response last week to your three-part column series on Jim Donovan, the voice of the Browns. I just want to read a couple of them. This one's from John S. He says, "Hey, Terry, just read the last of the three installments on your articles on Jim Donovan. I never knew too much about Jim because I relocated to California in 1978 and have to listen to the national announcers when I watch the Browns telecast. I'm a cancer survivor myself, but my treatment was minuscule compared to what Jim had to endure. A very inspiring story, and my hat is off to Jim and his family. I'll be looking at him in an entirely different light here and after, knowing what a brave and courageous man he is. Cleveland has had a lot of misfortune on the field of play, but boy, have we been blessed with some fabulous announcers, and listening to some of Jim's calls on YouTube, he definitely belongs in the company of Gib, Nev, Joe, Tom, Fred, etc. I actually go back to Jimmy Dudley. Thanks, as always, for your stellar writing." That's from John S. Thanks for writing that in, John. Terry, you got a lot of great response to that last week, and you kind of did it in three parts, two parts about Jim Donovan's story, and the third part about his battle with cancer. And you want to talk for a minute about kind of what you heard from people after that?
Well, the background is interesting because I wasn't sure exactly where I was going with it, other than I wanted something that didn't have Deshaun Watson before training camp, something that, you know, people could read it and feel good or whatever. And then I realized I didn't know much about Donovan's background other than he's from Boston. And then I went on the internet and I still didn't find much about Donovan's background other than he's from Boston. So I called up Jimmy. I said, "Hey, you know, I want to come over, want to write something on you." And I was just kind of thinking one story at that point. Well, we sit there, and he lives in a southwestern suburb, And on 12 acres, they got a barn. They got a couple of horses, he and his wife, Cheryl. And just kind of sitting on the porch, there was a nice day. And I got him talking about growing up in Boston, you know, his early career. And it's like, I've never heard any of this. And so that became, you know, the story number one, you know, the little kid at 12 years old sitting at a Boston Bruins game with a cassette tape recorder doing play by play next to his dad. And then I didn't realize, I always sort of thought he was a TV guy. I did not realize that his goal in the beginning of life was radio. And St. Cloud, Minnesota, I loved it. He said, on Broadcast Magazine, said, the home of one of America's five great radio stations. He goes, I'm excited. There's a one ad that says St. Cloud, Minnesota. He goes, so I had to check the map to see where one of five great radio stations is located. And he sort of got the job out of a magazine. You know, he went there and they hired him. And he spent 2 years there doing hundreds, literally hundreds of sporting events, living in some guy's basement because he was making no money. Then he went to Vermont, to Burlington, up on Lake Champlain. And there, towards the end, he started doing some TV, but he did like, there were the Vermont Reds. They're now the Akron Rubber Ducks, by the way, if you track where that team went. And he did St. Michael's college basketball. I did a bunch of high schools. So it's a total of 7 years between St. Cloud and Vermont before he got a chance to come to Cleveland. And the way he was discovered was there was an agent who was just looking at some tapes of actually somebody else on the same TV newscast as Jim. And he took her on as a client. And then he called Jim, said, you mind if I kind of market you around? And he ended up getting Jim an interview in Cleveland and they hired him. He came in as a weekend guy. That was 1985. Think about that. He's been in the market since 85. That also surprised me. And then so then we went to, you know, he didn't get the Browns till 93. But his goal always was play-by-play local. You know, he did. I forgot about the fact that he did regional NFL games for NBC. And so that whole part of the story is very interesting to me, too. I'm always kind of fascinated by how do people get to where they are.
Yeah, and the thing I think we talked about this last week is just play-by-play was so important to him, doing radio play-by-play. Mm-hmm. Of all the TV stuff he's done, it was always about getting a radio play-by-play gig with a team that he would really just love doing. And it's great to see someone who sitting at Boston Bruins games doing hockey. If you can do hockey, you can do any sport because it moves so fast. But trained him well.
And actually, that's probably his favorite sport. But like all great broadcasters, and I've gotten to know several. Joe Tate and I were close friends. Tom Hamilton, in fact, I was talking to Tom Hamilton today. We're close friends. Nev Chandler and I work very close, those three especially. And the thing that you discover when you talk to them, and Jimmy is the same thing, is they like sports, but they love broadcasting. The different events that they love broadcasting. It's just like, David, I like sports, but I love to write. I get more excited about, for example, putting Jimmy Donovan's story together and making sure I could tell that story the right way, which then broke into three parts because I suddenly realized I had so much, as opposed to, you know, sitting there looking at tapes of the Browns and trying to break down the X's and O's. You know, other people are better at that than I am. But the best writers, the best play-by-play guys, set the scene, they're storytellers. You know, it's like you are handed a coloring book. So you have the outlines of whatever picture it is, you know, a boat with a lighthouse in the background and water, but you color it in. You know, now if you're doing your job, you don't pretend that the boat on the water with the lighthouse is really a tiger, you know, chasing a hyena through the jungle. No, you don't do that. You've given the outlines, but to make that picture look like something, you color it in the right way. And I always say 80% it's like Tom Hamilton was talking about Donovan. And he said that, and he's been through both, the good and bad. And he said the tough thing for Jimmy is year after year of bad teams, decade after decade. He said when you have a really good team or you have a contending team, those broadcasts almost do themselves. But, you know, you're 3 months into the season and it's going nowhere. And you really have to push yourself to be enthusiastic, but not be stupid. You know, you can't be blind to what's going on. And that's the other thing that you see from Jimmy, and you saw from Joe Tay, you see from Tom Hamilton. I think it was Andre Knott told me, he said, you can listen to them about 5 or 10 minutes in the game and out here in the score, and you got kind of an idea how it's going for their local team.
Yeah, and Jim Donovan, like all the great ones, Terry, they know when to talk, but they also know when not to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim's had to go back and forth from TV to radio, and he always – the timing is just impeccable. So listen, check out that three-part series if you haven't read it already. It's definitely worth your time. So, all right, Terry, we're running a little short on time. I want to move to your Faith in You column for this week. You write about the dark night of the soul. The headline is, Where Do We Go During the Dark Night of the Soul? That column will be on Cleveland.com on Saturday and then in Sunday's Plain Dealer. And you kind of wrote about some tough days you went through with your father and kind of what came out of that for you personally. Why don't you share that for a moment?
Well, the dark night of the soul is a phrase from a monk and a priest, and now a Catholic saint called St. John of the Cross. It also has popped up in a lot of other things in literature. I remember I found a phrase from Scott Fitzgerald who said, the darkest nights of the soul are when it's 3 o'clock in the morning, day after day. You know, it just kind of drags on. And I would talk about how when I was taking care of my father and he had a stroke and it was very tough breathing. Late at night, he would just stare at me. We're just trying to get through the night. You know, you realize, at least in my case, it didn't matter how many books I'd written or awards I'd won or that I was a sports writer. We're just trying to, he's dealing with congestive heart failure. He had a stroke. He's scared. And then you literally are looking, you know, life and death issues in the eye. You know, what does that do? The dark night of the soul. So that started. Actually, that idea came out of a conversation I had with a pastor from Cleveland Heights. His name is Keith James, and we were talking about different things. And he said, you know, there's one of his favorite stories in the Bibles where Jesus gives a tough sermon, and all these people leave. Instead of usually, you know, they didn't like what he was talking about that day. And Jesus looks at his 12 disciples and says, are you going to leave me too? And Peter, one of the disciples, looks up and says, no, Lord, where else would we go? And that's kind of when you're in the dark night of the soul, that's your question, where else do you go spiritually? And, you know, there's a lot of people going to all kinds of escapism and things. So that's where the column came from. And I granted, it's not a boy, that's really exciting. I can't wait to read about the dark night of the soul, but I do think with most of us are honest, we have been in one, are in one, or might end up in one. Because that's life.
Yeah, and one of the quotes that really stuck with me too, Terry, was, and I forget who said this, but it was that God is in the pain with you, mm-hmm. and that you that you're not alone at those times. That something will come out of it in the end that will change you because of it.
And yeah, T.S. Really Eliot said that in one of his poems, and also Father Tom Heron mentioned that too. So,
really good stuff. Catch that this weekend. Terry's Faith in You column. There's always something in there that will resonate. And so give it a look. So, all right, we got a few Hey Terry questions to close. Terry, you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. All right. Hey Terry, this is from Steve Schaefer. Why is Shane Bieber still here? Isn't Cleveland required to trade away Cy Young Award winners? You were kind of joking about this earlier, but
yeah, we mentioned that earlier. They were, but it actually got me kind of looking. Well, whatever happened to the other Cy Young Award winners and what did they get for them? Well, the guy that closed out the All-Star game was one. They got him for Corey Kluber. And then when they traded CeCe Sabathia, actually the key player in the trade was supposed to be Matt LaPorta, and he ended up having a major hip injury. His career was cut short. But the player to be named later in that deal was, David?
I can't remember, Terry.
Michael Brantley.
Oh, that's right.
And see, that's exactly it. Who played here 10 years.
And Matt LaPorta actually had a little bit more fanfare, if I remember. He was
The guy.
A big power hitter and injuries, and he never really quite found. That's why I was having trouble coming up with Michael Brantley, yeah.
Michael Brantley ended up saving the trade for him, really, because otherwise it would have been a disaster. And there were a couple other guys in the deal, not even worth mentioning. And then the third Cy Young Award winner they traded was Cliff Lee. And they got a bunch of guys from Philly, but the main one was Carlos Carrasco, who pitched here for 11 years. Carrasco won 30 more games with Cleveland than Cliff Lee did for the rest of his career. And that's why now when I see maybe the Guardians may end up trading Bieber, I have a fair amount of confidence. Now, granted, some versions of the front offices made different made those trades, but they all were – Chris Antonetti was involved with them all. Early on, he was the assistant to Mark Shapiro. Those were the trades that brought Carrasco and Brantley in, and then he himself made the trade for Classe. And when they're all made, you go, that's all they got. Every single time you say that's all they got. You look at, by the way, Lee was traded a couple other times after that, and you look and see what was those teams brought back. They would have loved to have gotten Carrasco. And by the way, when they traded Sabathia, that was with a half year left. And the word was already out. The Yankees were going to break the bank for him. Milwaukee traded for him, and they just did it to make the playoffs. And CC actually pitched every fourth day instead of fifth and pitched him into the playoffs. And then he signed for zillions of dollars with the Yankees. So that's kind of how that played out.
All right. It's like every time the Guardians make a trade, you could do a lineage. It's like tracing the Herschel Walker trade between the Vikings and the Cowboys. It just goes on and on and on. Some of these.
Right. I mean, if you just want to, you know, you kind of keep going and, you know, Carrasco was part of the trade along with Lindor that went to the Mets that brings Jimenez and Rosario here. So,
yep, that would make a great graphic sometime. Let's see if we can get that together. So, all right, last one, Terry. This is from Greg Arbogast. He says, hey, Terry, are the Browns waiting on the Watson news before going all in for this year? Seems like a lot of money is on the table that could be spent. And you've written this, Terry, the Browns are $48 million under the cap for this season. Why don't you talk about the salary cap real quick? It is convoluted, and why don't you explain why they are where they're at?
And secondly, the next team with the most cap room is Dallas with $22 million. Dallas rarely, by the way, is that much under the cap. They're usually always fighting to get under the cap. Part of the reason they are is they got rid of Amari Cooper, by the way. That was a cap move. So the thing that you have to remember about the NFL is you can take your excess cap room and roll it over to the next season. Because right now, I believe the Browns are something like 28 or 30 million over the cap in 2023. Because that's when Watson's contract kicks in. Because when they sign these guys to these extensions, they make it real cap friendly the first year. And then after that, it balloons. I mean, next year, Watson counts $56 million on the cap. So that,
and Myles Garrett is next year too, right?
Myles Garrett is next year, and Betonio and Chubb, Denzel Ward, they're all big money. So, and Cooper, if they keep him, Cooper's contract's a little funky. They may be able to get out of it, but the idea being that they want to roll that into next year so that they don't have to turn around and start cutting guys because they're already way over. And that's the main reason. Now, that still gives them some room if they want to do something this year. But that doesn't mean they're going to go out and spend $20 million of that on somebody. No, I would be shocked if they did that.
Yeah, and even who would be left? Most of the guys who are worth money are gone, and it's mostly guys that are kind of just hanging around to fill holes. So, all right, Terry. Thanks for those. Hey, if you want to drop us a Hey Terry question for the podcast, you can send it to sports@cleveland.com and just put Hey Terry in the subject line. Or you can go to Terry's Facebook page and he will catch you there. So, all right, Terry, I think you're going to be doing some hiking next week. So we'll see if we can get a podcast together, but we'll see how things are going. You're going to be hiking, right? It's your annual hiking.
Yeah, we're going up to the Upper Peninsula. So that's where we'll be for about 10 days.
All right. We'll see if you can find any Choco Tacos while you're out there and you can sell them on eBay or something because they're going to be
They have whitefish tacos up there.
Oh, that sounds good.
Whitefish is big in Lake Superior. It's very good. So
I will eat any kind of fish tacos. Those are always good. So, and then you can have a Choco Taco for dessert. So we have a great time with these, and we appreciate you listening. We will catch you next time. Terry's talking.